proof. Okay, so I'm sure you all know the story about this little girl that comes to her father, her mother, and she says to her mother, how did the human race appear? So her mother answers, well, God made Adam, and then he took one of the ribs of Adam, and from there he made Eve, and they lived in the Garden of Eden, and finally they were expelled out of the Garden of Eden, naked and alone, and then they had children, and from their children all of mankind were born. 2 days later, the girl goes to her father and asks him the same question. The father answers, well, many years ago, there were monkeys, and the human race evolved from those monkeys. So the girl's very confused. She returns to her mother and she says, Mom, how is it possible that you told me that we were created by God and Dad said that we developed from monkeys? So the mother answers, well, dear, it's very simple. I told you about my side of the family and your father told you about his side of the family. So evolution is actually a very flexible and extremely malleable word. It can mean anything from your child's reading, as in your daughter's reading is evolving nicely, your reading skills are evolving nicely, to the fact that we all are descendants from a common ancestor, which is probably the more typical biological definition. Obviously, any problem that I'm going to have with evolution is not with the forces of evolution which are apparent all around us. I mean, everybody from the mystics who speak about how the godly light evolves from God's essence in order to transition and manifest into the creation of this physical universe, to the fact that you see a fetus evolving in its mother's womb, to the fact that we even see evolution in species over multiple generations. All of that is pretty much an established fact. The problem that I'm going to have, any problem that I'm going to have, is going to be against the theory of evolution. You know, there was this zookeeper who once noticed that an orangutan was reading two books. The one book was the Bible and the other one was Darwin's Origin of the Species. So the zookeeper is very surprised. He comes to the ape and he says to him, why are you reading both of these books? So the orangutan answers, I'm trying to determine if I am my brother's keeper or my keeper's brother. So orangutans aren't the only one that are confused. Try and be a believer like I am in this modern world and you are bombarded with all sorts of talk about evolution from your teachers in the youngest grades of school to textbooks as you go through school, to museums, to scientific, respectable scientific journals, to educational programs on TV, to radio programs. Wherever you look and turn, evolution is presented as an absolute fact. But in fact, it is not a fact. It is only a theory. And in fact, in my opinion, it is probably the most flawed scientific theory ever proposed. I'd like to remind you of the Webster's Dictionary definition, by the way, of the word theory. A theory means an assumption based on limited information, a conjecture, a speculation, and a concept that is not yet verified. Well, the theory of evolution deserves that title in the sense that the dictionary gives it, because it is absolutely a theory. In other words, you cannot in any way define the theory of evolution. There is no proof, there is no evidence. In fact, there's mounting evidence that shows that it is actually quite a weak theory. So that begs the question, and I'm going to get into the science in a moment, but I just want to spend a little bit of time on the philosophy, and that begs the question, why, in spite of growing evidence, mounting evidence, that evolution has fundamental flaws, scientific arguments, not religious arguments, I'm not going to quote the Bible here to prove the Bible, why then is this theory so stubbornly adhered to, even though for the last 50 years there's been mounting evidence that it is pure fiction and folly. And the answer is probably because what's the alternative? The alternative, if you don't accept creation theory, as we'll talk about in a moment, if you don't accept evolution, is you have to accept creation theory. You have to accept that God created the world. And that is a big crimp on your style, because if you accept that an intelligent being created the world, you have to ask the next logical question, which is why would he do that? Since we're not a result of a random accident, but something purposely made us, put life on this earth, why did he do it? And then your get out of jail free card, which is evolution, is now ineffective. So therefore, even though science itself is constantly disproving evolution every single day and coming up with another fundamental flaw and fatal flaw, nonetheless, we still tenaciously cling to this, because the alternative is you have to believe that God created the universe. So Arthur Keith, who is a famous British evolutionist, said, "Evolution is unproved and unprovable. We believe it only because the lone alternative is creation, special creation, which is creation by God." Now, would a Darwinist ever cheat? Would a scientist ever misrepresent? How strong is this need to cling to Darwinism? Well, it's so strong that there's been a number of very famous hoaxes to try and fill in the problems with Darwinism, but they have all been disproven. I'm thinking of Haeckel's embryos, where he showed depictions of embryos that looked like they were representing macroevolution in a very inside a mother's womb. There were the Piltdown Man, Nebraska Man, and other elaborate frauds, which were all desperate attempts to fill in the gaps that Darwin had, literally, gaps in the fossil record, to make this thing work, because they will try desperately to make it work under all circumstances. And finally, before we actually enter into the science, I just want to say a word about the implications of beliefs, because beliefs do have implications. Darwin's theory parades as science, but in fact it has had very serious repercussions in the way that we structure our societies, in the way that we think about each other, and certainly the weakest amongst us. Because if you believe in the evolutionary fiction fantasy of how things were created randomly, then you don't have to behave with any moral imperative. Richard Dawkins is one of probably the most famous atheists in the world today, a very rabid atheist and fundamental atheist. He wrote a book called The Selfish Gene. And in his book, The Selfish Gene, he said, and I quote, "You are nothing. You are here to propagate your selfish genes. There is no higher purpose in life." And then he continues, "My own feeling is that a human society based simply on evolution would be a very nasty society in which to live. A very nasty society indeed. Because just like a lion does not feel any remorse that it killed the beloved child of a gazelle for its new meal, or when a dog steals a bone from one of its peers, it doesn't feel any guilt. Well, if you are the end of a long line of animals, and we're just, you know, the next evolutionary step in this evolutionary tree of animals, why should we behave in any way different to, or feel or react in any way different to a gorilla or to an animal? There is no place for morality." And
sure. But just take you up on that one. Why not? Why can't morality evolve as well? Why does evolution have to be only in physical makeup? Why can't it be in inner feelings as well?
Because it's not reliable. Inner feelings are not reliable. So if you take the German example, where they were a very evolved society. I mean, they were the pinnacle of the art world. Was Germany. They were the forefront of scientific achievement, psychology. I mean, you know, pick any field of human endeavor, they excelled in it. And yet, they behave worse than any animal has ever behaved in history. Not because they didn't have a very sophisticated set of morals and ethics, but it was a subjective set of morals and ethics. So they would say, if you would ask a Nazi, is it wrong to kill or to murder? He would say, well, absolutely. Murdering is a heinous, terrible crime. And then you say, well, isn't that inconsistent with your day job because you kind of like do this for a living? And he would say, no. You see, Jews are cockroaches, and there's nothing morally reprehensible about killing a cockroach. So again, when evolution evolved, when morals are evolutionary, in other words, they come from a natural order, then they are unreliable. While if they're absolute, if you peg them to some religious notion of a creator who's imposed them, then there's no, it's much more consistent. Not absolutely
well,
consistent,
I mean, they had
much
warped, more consistent. They had a warped set of morals and
yes.
ethics. But then
so that's the danger.
There were probably a fair number of warped morals and ethics still existing in the world which claimed to be based on religions.
Correct. I will speak about that.
I'm a little bit.
What's that?
I don't want to do it.
How about? Can we do this, please? Let's come back because this is a fascinating topic. So I will come back to this at the end. Please remind me if I forget. But I do, since we're on the German model, I do want to point out that in Mein Kampf, Hitler uses the word for evolution, the German word, Entwicklung. Many, many times, and in fact he criticizes in Mein Kampf the Jews for bringing, this is a quote, the Negroes into the Rhineland with the aim of ruining or polluting the white race. So he, and if you think that Hitler made that up on himself, Darwin himself, I would remind you that Darwin spoke about the gorilla and the Negro, and this is again a quote, I don't endorse this at all, obviously, but nonetheless, it was certainly a belief that Darwin had, that the gorilla and the Negro occupy evolutionary positions somewhere between the baboons and the civilized races of man or the Caucasians. So that's what Darwin said, and that wasn't just a slip of Darwin's pen, that his writings positively drip with contempt for what he calls primitive people. So Erich Fromm, who was a German philosopher, said that if Hitler believed in anything at all, then it was in the laws of evolution, because they justified and they sanctified his actions, and most especially his cruelties. Because actually the subtitle, it's very interesting, the subtitle of Origin of the Species, does anyone know what the subtitle was of the book? It was Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. So the whole philosophy of Nazism is really based on, you know, survival of the fittest, which Hitler defined as the fittest being the German race, and everybody else was inferior or weaker and therefore had to be culled from, so he was helping or speeding along evolution as far as he was concerned. So again, before, and I will now enter into some scientific discussion, but before we do that, just to set the ground, to lay out the lay of the land, if you have a choice between creationism and Darwinism, why would you choose, even without getting into the scientific discussion, why would you choose something like Darwinism, which has potentially so much that could come from it that is destructive and immoral, and it sets yourself up for, you know, kind of euthanasia and ethnic cleansing, and all of these things are all based, that whole notion that is really based that somehow we pollute, some people pollute the other races, the favored races, has its you know, is certainly bolstered by this theory. So just looking at it like that, and as a Jew, I am a little bit reluctant to accept this theory as dogma. Anyway.
Well, we also have to look at the violence that's been perpetrated in the name of religion, which I think far outstrips the violence that's been perpetrated in the name of evolution.
can we put that onto the same question? It's really fascinating because I'm just completing my book now, and the chapter I'm writing is actually about this exact topic. So it's very much on my head, and I would love to engage you in the discussion on this. but we're not going to get through some of this fascinating stuff. So let me move. Yeah. So obviously, I mean, there was a time when there was peace reigned, when all scientists, in fact, all the real people who contributed to Darwinism, all were really believers in creationism. And in fact, that's why that was the birth of modern science. People like Newton and Kepler and Pascal and Boyle and Galileo and many, many others, they were all God-fearing and believing, they believed that God created the world. And because they believed that an intelligent being created the world, they went in search of intelligence within that creation, because it made perfect sense to them that if the creation was planned and by an intelligent being, that you would find signs of intelligence within that creation. And that's really what spawned and started the whole scientific explosion that we have experienced in the last 150 years. Now, Charles Darwin, as we know, he was this very wealthy son. He was a son of a very wealthy doctor and financier, and a very average student who liked hunting and horse riding and felt that his lectures at school were dull. So then when he came to his father and he said to his father, listen, I want to go on a world cruise. It's going to take 2 years. It ended up taking five, but he said he thought it would take about 2 years to go on this cruise. And his father said, absolutely not, but in the fine tradition of billionaire sons right throughout history, he got his way. And in 1835, he went on the British ship, the Beagle, and he went to the Galapagos Islands, amongst other places. And when he got there, he noticed certain turtles had adapted their necks. Those turtles where the foliage on islands where the foliage was somewhat higher, their necks were longer, and other turtles' necks were shorter. And so he created this mechanism that he called natural selection. And then one of his friends called it survival of the fittest, and then he started calling it that as well in later versions of the book. So survival of the fittest is a very easy concept to explain. It's very elegant, like most theories that gain great, that people, you know, accept in great numbers. This is an elegant and simple theory, and basically it says if you have developed some trait, some characteristic, which makes you like a long neck in an island where that is an advantageous appendage, then you will be able to reach the foliage, you will survive, you are more fit to survive, and nature will cull those who are weaker or those who have shorter necks, and then you'll marry somebody with a longer neck, and your children will be long-necked, and so it continues, right? Survival of the fittest. Everyone's aware of this concept. Now, according to the doctrine of survival of the fittest, you see over there, there's an ancient sea-dwelling creature which is similar to our modern eel, that is the progenitor, the start of all four-legged mammals come from this eel. So the Darwin story goes that this eel was busy swimming along, you know, highly streamlined, but developed two bumps on its behind. Now, being a lazy eel, it didn't go to the gym and work off those extra pounds. But instead it developed those bumps over millions of years into fins, and then those fins developed over millions of years, hundreds of millions of years, into legs, paws, and they crawled out, and there's where Fido the dog comes from. So that's Fido's great-great-great-grandfather was an eel. So the question, one question I have just parenthetically, which I always like to have fun with Darwinists about, is how come we still have eels today? If dogs and horses and cows and cats are more sophisticated and more fit to survive, how come there are so many species that are more primitive? Why do they stop in their evolutionary survival? Why do some species stop? But anyway, that's just parenthetic. I have a much bigger problem, and that is, if you're a streamlined electric eel and you're swimming away from your predators in the ocean and you get two bumps before there are fins. Now I agree, if you have fins they'll help propel you forward, but before they fins, in those millions of generations between the bumps and the fins, are those bumps a help or a hindrance? Do they allow you to swim faster, or do they make you less streamlined and more liable to be caught by your predators? So the obvious answer is that they're actually a hindrance. They do not help the eel get away until they are fins. Now, because evolution is blind, the naturalistic view of evolution, we don't know that it's going to evolve into fins, right? We think that we're caught at this stage where it's just two bumps on the side of the animal. So that's where we're caught, that's where we're trapped. Those animals that have bumps should die out and not develop it further into sophisticated and helpful fins. Now, this is one example. There are literally millions of examples where the initial stages of evolution are not a help. The initial appendages actually hold the animal back in some way, and therefore by the theory of survival of the fittest, by that doctrine itself, these animals should never have developed. And I don't know where Fido popped in over here. So I'll give you one other example just to solidify this, and that is the human eye, which we apparently are supposed to trace our ancestry back all the way to an animal that looks like our starfish, our modern starfish. So if you look at any starfish, by the way, it's very interesting. How many tentacles does a starfish have?
Five.
Or multiples of five, right? So that makes perfect sense, because how many fingers do you have in one hand? You have five. Do you see the family resemblance? It's striking, isn't it? So anyway, so our fingers obviously developed from those tentacles. And if you look at the starfish that's in the picture over there on the slide, you'll see that starfish have certain pigmentation on their skin, and underneath their tentacles they also have pigmentation which may be sensitive to light, and that pigmentation developed over many years to become the eye, the sophisticated human eye that we all possess. Two of most of us possess two working ones of. So the thing is, though, again, if you are a starfish and you develop acne in a color that does not allow you to fit in with the rest of your environment, then you are more visible to your predators and less fit to survive, and you should die off and not pass on that trait to your children with enough frequency to develop that over millions of years into a much more sophisticated organism and very helpful organism, i.e. the human eye. So those are a couple. So again, now you multiply that by millions and millions and millions of initial evolutionary stages that are not helpful to the animals, and you can see that how quickly all of this falls apart. Now, I just want to quote Jastrow here, Dr. Robert Jastrow, who said, and this is a direct quote, "Either life was created on the earth by the will of a being outside the grasp of scientific knowledge, i.e. God, or it evolved on our planet spontaneously through chemical reactions occurring in non-living matter lying on the surface of the planet." So it's a simple choice. If we can show that life could not happen through chemical reactions occurring from non-living matter, then we would have evidence that God must have created life. It's an either or. So if you can prove that that is an impossibility, that life could spontaneously erupt from non-living matter, then you must say that something came from somewhere, maybe from outer space or extraterrestrial or whatever, or God forbid, and created life. So Stanley Miller was this college student in 1953, and he actually produced some simple amino acids and other compounds in a laboratory. Well, the newspapers proclaimed Miller has made life in a test tube, and the scientific world was very excited. Remember, this was 1953, and for all this to work, You have to say that living organisms came from non-living life, but nobody had been able to do it in a laboratory, and this was very, very important to have this done in a laboratory setting so that we could at least prove that it was a possibility, because remember the either or, Jastrow's either or. If we cannot prove that, we have to fall back on the fact that God created the world. So did Miller actually give us the option, option B in the either or scenario? And the answer is no, because there are three key amino acids that are key in all living organisms that have never been, even post 1953, they have never been successfully created in a laboratory. Even when people have done experiments that create the perfect environment for these amino acids to come into being, they have not done it. So till they do that, I mean, we can't even have this discussion, we fall back. But many acids are created in all of these experiments which are harmful to the amino acids that are required for life. So yes, they create a few simple amino acids, not three of the key ones have never been created, but also in the process of creating these three amino acids, they also create other acids which compounds which destroy those amino acids. They're toxic to them. So the experiment actually proved, Miller's experiment, after all the hype died down and rational minds prevailed, that it is unbelievable to imagine that a living organism could come from a chemical soup of any description. Just skip Paulson for a second. So there are many, many different problems, many more severe problems with Darwinism. Maybe if we have some time, I'll go into it. But I just want to summarize. The theory of evolution is presented as a proven fact. Actually, there is more scientific evidence against the theory of evolution than there is that supports it today. The principles of the theory itself are what the evidence against it uses to discredit the theory, and there has never been a case of non-living chemicals creating a living organism, no matter how primitive, although scientists have tried desperately to accomplish that, and there is a certain Nobel Prize in it for anyone who does. So if you want to go ahead, you know, you will become very famous, because obviously we want to cling to that with all of our might. So one day a group of Darwinian scientists get together and they decide that man has come a long way, we've succeeded in accomplishing so many technological feats that there's no longer necessity for a supreme being, don't need God anymore. So they picked one Darwinian to go and tell God that they were done with him. So the guy walks up to God and he says, God, we've decided that we no longer need you. We've evolved to the point that we can clone people, we can do other miraculous things, so why don't you just go and get lost? And God listens patiently to this Darwinian, and then he says to him, once he's done talking, he says, very well, how about this? Let's say we have a man-making contest, to which the Darwinian happily agrees. So God adds, now, we're going to do this just like I did it back in the good old days with Adam. The Darwinian says, sure, no problem. And he bends down and he grabs himself a handful of dirt. And God reproachably says, no, 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 you get your own dirt. All right, so now you can attack me.
I've got a question.
Shoot.
You sort of explained to us that you can either believe in Darwinism or you can believe in evolution.
Yes.
Can you believe in creationism or Darwinism? Mm-hmm. Can you believe in creationism up to a point, but from that point onwards, we see before ourselves selective pressure happening. We see examples of groups of people who are better better equipped to sustain, etc. And we see a series of evolution happening, call it evolution, but a form of evolution happening from this point onwards.
What I said was that you can either believe that living organisms arose from non-living chemicals mm-hmm. or not. That was my either-or argument. Mm-hmm. There is something called theistic evolution, which is kind of a compromise between creationism and evolution. It's exactly what you